Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Friday, August 11th, 2011, and this is show number 325. Yep, we're early. We're doing it early this week because I'm actually going on vacation for a week. Now, in case you're wondering, I'm telling everybody on the internet I'm going on vacation, but we have our very own Mrs. Kravitz who lives across the street. If you're not familiar with the show Bewitched from the 1960s, I have a link in the show notes to an article about Bewitched and exactly who Mrs. Kravitz is. She is there to keep a nosy eye on our house. She'll be coming in and out at will to feed Buzzy so we can go away with peace of mind. She rocks. The other good news, besides the fact that you're getting the show early, is that next Sunday's show, that's August 21st, will be hosted by none other than Katie Floyd of the Mac Power Users Podcast. I said last week that it was going to be on Ustream and the live show, but then we figured out there's no reason she can't do it on Justin.tv, so we tested it this week, and it's all good to go. Now remember, we need you to send in audio recordings to katie@macpowerusers.com so she doesn't have to work so hard. The best part of this arrangement is that Steve and I will actually be back from our travels by Sunday night, so we'll be able to make snarky comments in the live chat room during the show. I just don't feel like doing any work while I'm on vacation doing all that writing I do every week. But maybe we'd better get the show done before I officially start goofing off for my vacation. But wait, before we get started, I just got a notification from the live chat room. Stefan Lesage from Belgium just pointed out to me that today is Friday, August 12th. Not August 11th. We took a vote in the chat room. I wanted to leave it as an Easter egg for Connor P. to tell me how wrong I am, because that makes him ever so happy. But Steve suggested that perhaps I just put a correction in here. Yes, today is Friday, August 12th. Now let's get down to work. My son turned me on to an interesting service I want to tell you about. Let's start with that venerable problem to be solved. You have a lovely laptop or phone that you adore. Might be a Mac, a Windows machine, or a Linux machine. You'd be devastated if you lost it. If someone stole it, and maybe you don't want your data out there floating around, you know, maybe you really would like to do something about that. There's a whole bunch of services you can pay big piles of money for to keep track of your devices, but like I said, they're really expensive. Well, Kyle found a free service that will track your device. It's called Prey, P-R-E-Y, with an E, and it's available at preyproject.com. Prey lets you keep track of your phone or laptop at all times, and oh, I should say one of the operating systems is Android, and that's why they talk about phones. It keeps track of your laptop and phone at all times, and it'll help you find out if it ever gets lost or stolen. This program is lightweight, open source software, and free for anyone to use. So first you install the Prey application on your device. Like I said, they have applications for Windows, Mac OS X, Ubuntu, a generic Linux install, and one for Android. It's actually in the Android market, so you can go get it there if you have an Android phone. They don't have one for iOS yet, but maybe they're working on it. I don't know. Once you install the software on your Mac, I'll just say Mac from now on because that's where I did it, it asks you to go back to the web and create a user account. And then it sends you an email to verify that you're human. That email takes you to a control panel where you can configure exactly what you want to have happen in case of theft. You get a switch to declare your device missing, and then there's a series of switches you can toggle on for what to do about that. By default, Prey will geolocate your device on a map, take a picture with a webcam of the person with your device, and it'll take a screenshot of what they're doing and even provides you network information on the device. Get this. Since the information is actually being sent by your computer, it also sends its external IP address and the LAN IP address. Not quite sure what you do with the LAN address, but it's there. I tested Prey with the default connections, and every 20 minutes, it pulled all of this data for me. I let it pull the data 7 times after I told it that it was stolen, and 6 out of the 7 times, it nailed my location dead nuts on. I mean, it wasn't an inch off my house. The one time it missed by more than a mile. Not sure what messed up that one time, because several of the times it was in the exact same physical location in the house. Now, I was really watching closely to see the camera take the picture of me, and only once out of 7 times did I actually catch it in the act. It was this really quick little green glow. I think that's a good thing, because maybe you don't want the bad guy to know that you're tracking him or her when you're on this. All right, let's get a little more advanced with Prey. How about setting an alarm to go off on your machine, or put an alert message on the screen? the default message, which you can edit, is to say, this is a stolen computer and is being tracked by prey. Please contact the owner at your address to resolve the situation. You can even have it say that message out loud with text-to-speech in this kind of robotic voice. There were two more options, but I got scared to try them. One was to lock the screen and require a password, but it's not your administrative password. It's a password on the prey site. I just had a feeling I might just forget it and that things would go horribly wrong. You can even have prey hide emails and delete cookies and passwords on your computer. Now, I assume they mean the kind where you let a web browser remember your passwords, but we're all too smart to ever do that, right? We're using LastPass or 1Password, all of us, right? Anyway, when I told Prey my machine was stolen and that alarm and message started playing, it was really disturbing. Like I said, this crazy loud siren went off and this very robot-like voice was yelling at me that the computer was stolen. Now, you can close that window with a message, but the shrieking goes on for quite a while, and then it comes back at the next time interval you set inside the Prey control panel. You can set that time interval anywhere from every 10 minutes to every 40 minutes. But that's not all. You can get Prey to send you a list of modified files, so the snot who took your computer is messing around in your files, you're going to know which ones he messed around in. All of this is with the free version of Prey for up to 3 devices. If you pay for a pro account, you can get sent reports if your machine doesn't report in for a certain length of time. So you can say, if I don't check in every hour or something like that, then something might have gotten wrong, so you won't have to actively go in and say it's stolen. You can also receive your reports SSL encrypted with the paid version and get ciphered instructions. I don't know what that means, but it sounds really cool. When you first activate Prey on your machine with a free account, you get a full hardware scan. If you buy the Pro account, you can run a hardware scan anytime you want, and you can have Prey updated remotely. Now, even though this is an open source project, you would never know it from the look and feel of the website where you control the tool. It's beautiful, it's clean, it's easy to understand. It doesn't look all dodgy like most open source software does. Now, the one way they show their open source colors is that it's actually hard to figure out how to pay for a pro account. I did finally find it after some scrolling and digging. A personal account is only $5 a month for up to 3 devices, but even then they give you a 10% discount if you pay that by the year. If you have a lot of devices, you can get a home account for $15 a month for 10 devices. There are plans for 30, 100, and even 500 devices, so if you run a company's IT devices, this might be a great option for you. And again, there's 10% off all of those if you go with the 1 year versus the month-to-month plan. But remember, everything else that I described is free up to 3 devices if that's the way you want to go. Prey even has a really good support section with a knowledge base where you can find answers from the maker of Prey and a forum where you can get help from the community. If you want to be able to track your computer or Android phone in case of theft, I think you should really consider putting Prey on your devices now before it's too late. Check it out at preyproject.com. That's P-R-E-Y project.com. Next up, we have another fabulous review from Rod Simmons of the Simple Mobile Review podcast. This week, he's going to talk to us about the iSound Portable Power Max from iSound.net.
Hi, Allison and fellow Nasilla Castaways. This is Rod Simmons from the Simple Mobile Review podcast, here to share with you a product I found called iSound. But first, let me start with a problem to solve. Power. We all need power. We need more power. Whether you're trying to charge your iPhone, or your 4G hotspot, or your Kindle, or your iPad, and the list goes on from all the USB devices that you can actually charge, we could all use a little bit of extra power. And it's always not handy. Sometimes you're in a conference room and you can only plug in on one port, but you need power all day long. Sometimes you're in an airport and you can't get power anywhere and your 4G hotspot's dead, and why would you run it off your computer and drain that battery faster? You get what I'm talking about. We could all use an extra boost. So I found a device called iSound. It's a 16,000 milliamp battery with 5 USB ports on the back, and it couldn't be any better. So let me tell you how I've used it. I've sat in an airport, had my 4G hotspot plugged in, had my phone plugged in, and I think that's it. And those were charging. And then my flight got delayed for 4 hours. And for 4 hours, my phone maintained perfect charge, my 4G hotspot stayed up and running, and I worked happily on my MacBook Air the entire time while I was sitting on the delay. Now, I was lucky enough to be one of the people who could actually plug into the wall and actually charge, but I was more than happy to switch in and out with my fellow travelers because I knew I could actually charge those devices. And while I said that I only plugged in my 4G hotspot and my phone, people who were surrounding around who just wanted to plug in a phone were happy to plug their phone into my 16,000 milliamp battery and actually charge their phones over USB versus tying up an outlet that a laptop user could use. I've also used this same device when I've been sitting in conference meetings where you're not quite at the wall, so you don't want to drape 20 cables back over to the wall to plug in and charge, but you're kind of on the edge. So my laptop cable goes over and charges, but everybody who's sitting at that desk or nearby, they turn around and slap their phone on the desk and plug it in for USB charge, and it becomes a community charger versus just my personal charger. So I've actually run this device for an entire day, an eight-hour workday, with five devices plugged in, two devices running 4G hotspots, and it's worked great. I'm a real big fan of the iSound. Now, on the front of the unit, you have two toggle switches, one that turns on the battery so that you're actually running the charge, another one that turns on a flashlight. For the life of me, I can't figure out why I would actually need a flashlight. Maybe they think I need to turn the light on to search through my bag. And then there's a little button on the front that you just press it, and it tells you how many bars you have left. So there's like five lights that light up. When you fully charge the battery, all five lights are illuminated. And as you deplete the battery, each one of the lights individually goes out until you're fully depleted. This device has been an absolute lifesaver. It's more than just a community charger for me. It's really just a way that I can actually sit in a meeting and actually not have to be that geek who pulls out 400 things to charge. I can silently turn this thing on in my bag, take my phone, drop it into my bag, and know that it's charging while it's sitting in my bag, or have my 4G hotspot running in my bag and not have to worry about people saying, "Oh, dude, you have a 4G hotspot. Can I jump on and share?" It's 4G, man. I need all the bandwidth for myself. So if you're like me and you want some additional battery power to power your devices, you should give a look at the iSound. Again, it's one of those devices you can grab on Amazon. It is available through Amazon Prime, so for free shipping. For the life of me, I can't remember the price. I think I paid like $75 for this, but it's definitely a lifesaver. There's tons of devices out there. I've used the Energizer XP18000, which is another incredible device. But the thing that settled me on the iSound was the fact that, unlike the Energizer, it has five USB ports. So it's not just about charging one of my devices at a time, but it's about charging all of my devices. Now, if I'm stingy with this, I can actually use it for an entire week. Give it a shot. Tell me what you think. Love to hear some feedback.
So, you know, a lot of people write to me, and probably the most notable whiner about this is Dean Elger. They complain to me that listening to the NoSilicast is a very expensive operation. Now, I think I know what you're talking about. Last week, as soon as I heard Rod's review, I went out and bought the dry case. And as soon as I heard his review on the iSound, I had to buy that too. I mean, come on, how can you argue with $77 for 16,000 milliamp hours? I actually thought he misspoke when I heard that. You need to understand how big that really is. All of those cute little iPhone battery pack things you can get, they're like 1,600 milliamp hours, 1,800. You might see something over a couple thousand, but tens of thousands of milliamp hours. I mean, you can power all kinds of crud for that. That's really cool. Now, I should mention that Rod made a point offline to tell me that the iSound, by the way, that's spelled i.sound, the i.sound power pack only charges at 5 volts versus the 10 volts necessary for the iPad to fully charge. So it works like it's using an iPhone charger, which I think means it takes like 28 days to charge up an iPad. But that's all right. He said that the only great device for charging the iPad at full speed is the Zag Spark 2.0, but the battery for that's really small. He said, I thought his version of small was interesting. I checked out the Zag Spark 2, and it's actually 6,000 milliamp hours all by itself. It's a really nice little compact wall charger battery pack combo. I made a point of using Rod's Amazon affiliate link over on the Simple Mobile Review website for the Zag Spark 2 and for the i.sound, and I really hope you click those to help him out. I also have to tell you that after listening to this, these last two reviews, I thought, you know, he keeps saying he's from this podcast. What is it called? The Simple Mobile Review Podcast. Well, maybe I ought to go check it out. You know what? It's fantastic. I listened to a little over an hour long show today, and it was wonderful. He does it with a couple other guys, and I got to warn you, it's got a whole lot of Windows type stuff in it. They're hardcore Windows guys. They're doing Windows Phone 7, but they had a great interview with a guy from Microsoft, and it was super fun. I'm going to stack a couple of those ready to listen to in the car on the way up on our vacation, because I really, really enjoy his work. In fact, I'm pretty sure I'm going to trick him into being on a chit chat across the pond. He's the kind of guy to just stir up some trouble with all his Apple bigots. Don't you think that'll be fun? I do. When it comes time to buy a new monitor for your Mac, it's kind of hard to figure out what to buy. Because on the one hand, you could buy the spectacular Apple Cinema display and, you know, take out a second mortgage on the house to pay for it. Or for about half the price or less, you could get some other kind of brand, you know, like a Dell, for example. Perfectly acceptable. This has been a dilemma for years and years. I'm going to tell you why I picked the Apple Cinema display the last time, in spite of the temptation to spend half as much money for something that would be perceived as being just as good. Here's why. 9 years ago, I got a 22-inch cinema display at work. That was back when I was allowed to use a Mac. Those days are over. Anyway, this model was the one with the giant 2-inch white border around it, so it looked huge. The monitor was 1600 by 1200 DPI. This was the first time Apple decided to change up all of the connectors. You know how they do that periodically just to mess with you. They'd come out with what they called the ADC connector. And somebody in the chat room, tell me what ADC stands for. I forgot. The Apple something connector. Anyway, the idea was it carried USB, power, and video all in one cable. It's kind of starting to sound familiar with the way they're doing things with Thunderbolt, doesn't it? Anyway, you needed a special graphics card to use this. It had to have 32 megabytes on it, don't you know? It was so cool at the time. So then Apple decided to change to DVI. Oh, man. So I got a new Mac. It had DVI. I've got this 22-inch cinema display. What am I going to do? That meant you couldn't use that ADC display on any of those new Macs. It was so aggravating to have this super expensive monitor with no way to plug it in. Luckily, the folks at Dr. Bot came out with an adapter that would take the ADC cable as an input and then split it out into power, USB, and video, sort of defeating the purpose of the whole idea of having this one nice clean cable, but at least I could use my monitor. This adapter, as they call it, wasn't some tiny little device. I remember a reviewer at the time aptly describing it as the size of a three-egg omelet. This thing was huge. But at least it was expensive and clumsy with four cables coming out of it, and the ADC adapter cable was super thick and inflexible, so it was really hard to move around. All right, let's see quickly here. Nick just told me ADC stands for Apple Display Connector. Thank you very much, Nick. Good job on the research there. All right, well, that solved my problem. So I'm a couple hundred dollars lighter, but at least I got to use my 22-inch cinema display. Now, this particular 22-inch ADC display had cost a couple thousand dollars at the time. This is way back, 9 years ago. So breathing new life into it was a great investment. Now, fast forward to about 3 years ago when I was forced to use a PC. Oh, well, moving on. Even though the world has gone on to digital connectors, you know, DVI by this time, most PC laptops still seem to come with VGA connectors. I mean, even really high-end laptops, workstation-class laptops. So here I am with an ADC to DVI adapter, but no VGA. I thought, hey, no worries. I'll just buy one of those little DVI to VGA connector adapter things, you know, little 2-inch square things. Easy peasy, no problem. I bought two of them before I figured out, or I think a smart person told me, a guy named Adam, that you actually need what's called a scaler to make that work. I think it had something to do with the graphics card and the PC not being able to drive the native 1600 by 1200 resolution of the display. So, I found a company called Geffen, and I bought their scaler, which cost about $350 more. Now, the scaler isn't nearly as big as the Dr. Bot device, but lucky for me, it also comes with giant, thick cables that are entirely too stiff to move around easily. One is for power, one's for VGA that is about the thickness of my finger. I wrote in the show notes it was half the thickness, but I double-checked it. It's almost as big as my pinky in thickness. It took some real fiddling with this device and some severe tech support from Geffen. I believe we had to mail it to them twice to get it to work. But in the end, I finally had success. So now realize, I didn't say that took the place of the Dr. Bot. it's in series with the Dr. Bot. I mean, the two things are connected together. So I've got like 9 cables and these 2 giant boxes, and all these cables are as stiff as your arm trying to move it around. All right, so why am I telling you this horror story of the Frankenstein I built with all this junk hanging off a 9-year-old monitor? I'll tell you, because about twice a month, someone new walks into my office and says, "Hey, how'd you get that really cool monitor?" I'm not making this up. It happens all the time. I love this monitor. Even though there's much higher resolution ones out there, this monitor is gorgeous. The colors are still bright. The display is still really clear. And I got to confess, another reason I like it is because for a 22-inch display, it's actually a pretty low resolution for that size. Remember George from Tulsa describing how he had to keep wiping nose prints off the glass on his 27-inch iMac because the text was so tiny? In fact, he ended up giving it away to somebody else in the company because he couldn't read it. That's not a problem with a 22-inch display that's only 1600 by 1200. I love how big and bright it is with fonts I can actually read. At the same time that I bought the 22-inch ADC cinema display at work, we bought a 17-inch one for home. And trust me, it wasn't a couple $1,000s. I forget how much it was, but it was still a trunk load of money. Well, late last year, I gave away the computer it was hooked to, along with that 17-inch ADC display, and it looks just as good as the 22-inch one does at work after 9 years. It shows no sign of slowing. So the moral of the story is, if you're looking at the Apple Cinema displays and drooling, but you think they're just priced too darn high, consider my story. This display could last you a decade, as long as you're willing to buy adapters, if they're made as well as they were in the early days. I bought a 24-inch cinema display when they came out, even though it was a ton more money than the typical Dell display, but I think it's been worth it. The new Apple 27-inch display is $1,000. So I thought, okay, to tell this story, I really should see what a Dell would cost at that resolution. I checked, and there's a 27-inch 2560 by 1440 LED backlit display that is the same resolution as the Mac one. So that model is called the Dell U2711. Same resolution, doesn't have an EyeSight HD camera, but it doesn't have Thunderbolt. It has DVI and DisplayPort and VGA and it says DMI. I'm not sure what that was. Guess how much it costs? $1,000. I'm just saying. So you know I'm crazy about Text Expander, but I thought it'd be fun to find out how other people are using Text Expander. Maybe trigger in your mind how you could use it to make you more productive and reduce repetitive stress by reducing your typing. I sent out a tweet and asked people, what's your favorite Text Expander snippet? I got a couple of responses in time from Twitter in time for the show. First, Bonnyface, also known as Julie Cool, said her favorite Text Expander snippet is how she can type in R-E-S-U-M-E, resume, without an apostrophe, or with an apostrophe at the end, and Text Expander automatically changes it into resume, with a something you on both E's. So that gives her the correct accents, and it looks beautiful. I didn't even know about that one. That's really cool. I took a look at the automatically include snippets you get under the folder accented words, and there's a ton of them in there. My favorite I did notice was debacle. I type D-E-B-A-C-L-E, and it automatically puts an accent aigu on the E and a circumflex on the A. I just love it. It looks really cool. I didn't even know those were supposed to be there. I didn't find it until I typed it, and Text Expander fixed it for me. All right, maybe Julie and I are a bit nuts about the accented words being exactly correct. How about some more common uses? Brian Saylor, also known as B. Saylor on Twitter, is often in correspondence with his students, and he finishes every email by simply typing IYHAQ. I looked at that first time, and I'm thinking, IYHAQ, what is that? Well, it expands to say, if you have any questions, let me know. That was a fantastic use. Now, Nick, also known as Bleep Nick, responded to my question of what he uses Text Expander for, and he said, sadly, it's kind of boring. My signature. Now, that's not sad at all. That's the thing that we probably all have in common. It's the best use of Text Expander. You know, while we've been sitting here, or while we've been talking, I'm on the live chat, and Nick just tweeted or sent a message that said he's expanded 3,395 snippets for characters saved of 410,000 characters saved. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I think that's really cool. So back to the signature thing, I post on message boards all the time, and whenever I do, I make sure to market the podcast. I simply type S-I-G in a semicolon, and you get everything you'd ever want to know about the NoSilicast. I'm sure everybody likes that I do that. Mark Dalton also answered the tweet call, and he said, a couple of my most useful are X-Template, which produces a full HTML template for the Tech Lounge show posts. And Kyle McGuire uses AD semicolon to expand to the first line of his address. He uses EM semicolon to expand his email, which is really long. Now, that's kind of funny because that's exactly what I did. I use EM for just my email, and it's so much easier than just typing that out every time. Even if you're good at typing, it saves time. Now, Mark Dalton also has similar snippets for email and a phone number. And finally, Verso has boilerplate markdown text for bits of posts that are always the same. They live blog posts and try to give instructions for the TUAW TalkCast instructions. So you can see that there's all different kinds of uses for Text Expander. Not everyone uses the same, but they're all passionate about how much time they save. I love hearing about these different ways of saving time and work. Keep these ideas coming. Let me know what you use it for. Now, if you feel left out because you don't have Text Expander yet, head on over to smilesoftware.com and get the free trial. When you're hooked, buy Text Expander. And be sure to tell them the NoSilicast sent you. Before I get started in the next review, I should say we have a couple of firsts in the live chat today. Dorothy, also known as MacLurker on Twitter, is actually in the live chat room listening to audio at 30,000 feet. She's in an airplane, and she's at the live show. Now, it looks like the audio is a little broken up, buffering a little too much to be a good experience. So anyway, we thank her for giving it a good shot, and she's actually, like I said, she's still in the live chat and chatting with people. So this is pretty groundbreaking. And we also have our very first Finnish representative of the NoSilla Castaways. I don't think anyone from Finland has ever actually even written to me. This is definitely a first. And their Twitter name is HKI Online. Or actually, I don't know if that's a Twitter name, but that's their chat name. And I did not catch what their name is. But anyway, those are two groundbreaking things happening in the live chat, in case you're missing it and not there right now. All right, so I've done reviews in the recent past of the Samsung 4G hotspot, the Novatel 4G hotspot, and the Clear Rover Puck. This week, I have yet another device, the Sierra Wireless Overdrive Pro 3G/4G mobile hotspot from Sprint. Again, with a really long name, so that's a lot of help. So we're going to call this one the Sprint Overdrive Pro. It's really interesting to see how differently each of these devices have been constructed, the varying sizes, the lack or existence of displays of varying quality, and completely different shapes. It's neat to see the innovation as people are actually testing these out. You know, there's a lot of talk in the industry now about Apple suing everybody for making their phones or their tablets look like their stuff. And, you know, to be honest, I kind of think they're right. I mean, does everything have to look exactly the way they designed it? I mean, why does it all have to look the same? Why not come out with innovative shapes and sizes? I mean, you can do all kinds of things. You could have it squeeze and be narrow in the middle. Heck, do something fun. So anyway, back to the Sprint Overdrive Pro. It's a little over 2.5 by 2.5 by 0.7 inches thick. So it's kind of chunky and it's a little bit heavy, but it's really shiny and pleasing to hold. It's got these bevels on the corner. It's got little rubber feet on the bottom. Very, very pleasing little device. It has a very large color LCD screen on the front. It is by far the best display on any of the devices I've tested so far. It shows you the cell signal strength. It tells you if you're using 3G or 4G, and it doesn't like have a little blinky weird light you got to figure out, like on the Novatel. If it's blinking green, that's 4G, but if it's blinking, I think it's amber, that's 3G. I don't know. It's all confusing. On this, it just says 3G on the top. It tells you the number of connected devices, and it has a big battery indicator. It also tells you the name of the network, and if you choose, you can have it show the password you've assigned. You can turn that off if you don't want to have it displayed, though. When you first power up the device and connect it, opening a web browser automatically takes you to the admin screen. I love this. It forces you to look right at the settings for encryption, naming the network, and setting an administrator and wireless password. For the novice user, I think this really is ideal. Now, once you've answered those few questions, you're free to wander around the internet, or you can dig into the control panel a bit more. When you go to the URL for the Sprint Overdrive Pro later, you get a really cool display showing everything you can see on the screen of the device, but also the descriptions of each indicator. It showed two bars on the battery of the device, but on the browser, it explained clearly to me that I had 46% battery life remaining. I forgot to mention, the display on the device also shows you how much data you've used in the current session. When you're looking at the web interface, it's even better. It shows you how much usage total for the current month, and you can even set what day of the month that counter resets. How cool is that? Who else lets you monitor your usage like that? With all the data caps going around, that's a really cool feature. Now, I've mentioned before that I thought it was odd that you could only have 5 devices hooked up to one of these wireless hotspots. I mean, why is it 5? Why isn't it 4 or 6 or 3? Why are they all exactly 5? Well, the Sprint Overdrive Pro lets you set exactly how many devices you can connect, anywhere from 1 to 8 devices. So, there, it is arbitrary. I knew it. Well, remember how sad I was that the Novotel 4G hotspot would not allow me to use it when I was charging it via USB? And how excited I was way back when I found out how to hack the original MiFi to let me use it while I had it plugged in to charge? Well, the Sprint Overdrive Pro wins over all of them. Not only does it allow you to use the wireless aspects while plugged in via USB without hacking it, you can actually control that behavior with a software switch on the web interface. Your choices are to always have the Wi-Fi available when plugged in, or intentionally block Wi-Fi when plugged in and use it as a USB modem. So let's say you don't feel like sharing, just plug it in. Or you can have it never have Wi-Fi turned on when it's plugged in via USB. The flexibility is fantastic. I do have to say, though, that the Sprint Overdrive Pro gets smoking hot when it's plugged into USB. Almost too hot to touch, actually. I'm not sure that should really have happened. I could go on for hours about every cool thing they have in the web interface because, I mean, it was just a joy to play around in. But I have to say, this is the most user-friendly, pleasing to look at, and helpful interface I've seen on any router, including Linksys, D-Link, Apple, all of the hotspots I've played with so far. Bar none, Sprint has done the best job. Now, the Sprint Overdrive Pro has one odd little thing. It makes little noises. Happy little noises. Like when you first come on, it beeps and boops. When someone joins the network, this little beepy thing goes off, and then when it goes into standby mode, more cute little beeps and boops. The good news is that if all this cheery cuteness gets on your nerves, there is a mute switch on the device. All right, this entire review has been a complete and utter tease, because it's time for the bad news. Sprint's network, where I tested it, is the worst I've ever seen of any device. I mean any device. Let's dial back to the very original USB card stick that I used to use for before the MiFis were even invented. It's like 5 years back. It was better than this. The coverage map shows 3 colors. They have light orange, medium orange, and dark orange. I think to make it harder to tell the colors apart. Light orange means 3G, medium means 4G, but only if you're outdoors. And the dark orange means you can get 4G even inside a building. Who would have thought? Well, in Los Angeles County, the dark orange spots look like freckles on the city. It is very, very spotty. Medium orange is a bit more pervasive, but the areas where I live and work have no 4G coverage at all, even if I were to stand outside a building. Now, I could almost put up with this because that interface is so nice, but the coverage they call 3G is horrible. I ran a speed test over at speakeasy.net/speedtest. I ran it 3 or 4 times. The download speeds were from 110 to 430 kilobits per second. That's download. Less than half a megabit per second at the best I ever saw it. Hold on your seats, though. The upload speeds were as low as 20 kilobits per second. So those of you who are too young to remember the old dial-up modems, those were at 56 kilobits per second. This is at 20. This thing in my house ran at half dial-up modem speed. I did 3 tests, and I was going slower and slower on each test. I was afraid it would stop altogether if I kept testing it. You know, I had this thing connected on my Mac, and I kept forgetting I had done that. And then I'd get really confused why my FTP client wouldn't connect to my server or why images weren't showing up in Feeder when I was trying to look at them to see if they were up there correctly. And then I'd realize, oh, yeah, I'm on the Sprint network right now. I even tested this a few times at work, and once I got 1.1 megabits per second down and 230 kilobits per second. It's a lot better than at home, but even Sprint says on their website about this device that 3G is 3.1 megabits per second down. So I'm getting a third of what they promise. I am so bummed about this, and I can't imagine how bummed the people are who designed the hardware and software for the Sprint Overdrive Pro. It's actually made by Sierra Wireless, by the way. These people designed a very pleasing box, created easy to view and understand indicators on a gorgeous LCD display. They wrote best-in-class software for the web interface, and then they had their work put on such a dreadful network. That's got to be killing them. I feel for you guys. The Sprint Overdrive Pro will run you $250 without a contract, but around $50 with a 2-year contract. Pretty standard pricing for these devices. You can get plans of 3G for $45 a month. I'm sorry, 3 gigabytes for $45 a month, 5 gigabytes for $60 a month, or 10 gigabytes for $90. Hopefully you live somewhere where you can actually download that much data in a month. At the speeds I was getting, if I left it on for 24 hours a day for 30 straight days, I could just barely use 5 gigabytes of data. So, bottom line time. If you check the Sprint network in your area and you find you do have good 4G coverage, definitely try out the Sprint Overdrive Pro. I think you'll really, really love it. But make sure you can bring it back and get a full refund if it stinks. I got to tell you, though, if that map isn't showing you solid dark orange everywhere you want to go, don't even think about getting this device. It'll only make you sad. Or maybe keep an eye on Sprint, and if and when they get good coverage, then get yourself the Sprint Overdrive Pro. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this time we have a return guest. One of my favorite guests we've had on is Larry Bushy from the Going Linux podcast and website. And he's been a great friend and fun to talk to about Linux in the past. And we're going to dig in and do a little bit more this week. How are you doing today, Larry?
Doing great. Absolutely great. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, we've been trying to get this arranged for a while, but been ships passing in the night, right?
You bet. Finally.
So where should we start? Where did we leave off last time?
Yeah, it seems like a year ago. Well, let's see. I think last time we had talked a little bit about Linux, and you were asking me what was Linux distribution that you should try. I recommended Linux Mint, and at the time it was Linux Mint 10, and it's been so long that we have a whole new release. We're on Linux Mint 11 now. So let's talk about that.
So, yeah, I told you at the end of the last time we talked, it was quite a while ago, and I told you I was going to load it up and I was going to play with it. So 15 minutes before we started, I downloaded it, and that's when I realized it was 11. But the sad part is I had downloaded 10. I just hadn't launched it. I hadn't done anything with it. So I did want to talk a little bit about that and where things and why Linux Mint versus the other 162 distros out there, or Ubuntu, which seems to be a lot of people are happy with.
Well, sure. There are a lot of different choices with Linux, and you can choose everything from the geekiest version of Linux that requires you to build it from scratch and compile software, and probably not something that a new Linux user would want. And all the way down to something that is so minimalistic that it only has a command line, and that's it. So Linux Mint is in between those two extremes. It has a graphical user interface. It is designed specifically for everybody, including new users and switchers from Mac and Windows. And that's why it is very, very attractive.
So now, it's been tailored to try to make it be attractive for us so we don't be scared when we get in there?
That's it, exactly. Now, Ubuntu, which is from a different organization, they have been the penultimate of new user Linux distributions in the past. However, with the latest release of Ubuntu, they changed the entire user interface. Mm. And whereas Ubuntu was the most popular Linux distribution until they did that, when they did that, Linux Mint, at least as measured by its popularity on DistroWatch, the DistroWatch website is a website that lists all of the most popular and current and even some defunct Linux distributions and rates them by popularity as measured by the number of clicks they get on their website.
Okay.
And Linux Mint has taken over from Ubuntu. And
really?
I have started recommending Linux Mint even for people who are not recent switchers, but some for those folks using Linux that want to venture into something that gives them something that just works, that allows them to get things done, but allows them to do all the power user things that you would want to do if you were a Linux geek. So it really is designed for everybody.
Hmm. Well, that sounds like something I definitely should be checking out. Has it come a long ways in 11 versus 10?
They made quite a few changes to well, first of all, it is based on Ubuntu.
Okay.
And as a result, they have made some changes to update it to the latest release of Ubuntu under the hood, but they have stuck with the previous user interface. And one of the reasons that the user interface on Ubuntu has become I was going to say bad mouth. That may be a little bit too heavy-handed there, but a lot of Linux users have shied away from it because it has it's not finished. It is still in development. It is something that's not ready for prime time yet. And I don't know if you know anything about Ubuntu and the release cycles, but they release a new release every 6 months.
Right.
But about every 2 years, I think it is, they release a long-term support release. And a long-term support release is more along the lines of what you would expect from Mac or Windows or other Linux distributions that don't release quite so frequently. It is meant to be the all I's dotted and all T's crossed release of Ubuntu. And this latest release of Ubuntu, 11.04, is not one of those. It's one of the in-between releases. And as a result, they tend to experiment a little bit more. Not that the distribution is unstable, but rather they try new packages, they replace things with other things. Not that they've done this recently, but they might replace the Firefox browser with Chrome, for example. They haven't done that, but that would be an example of the kinds of things that happen in those interim releases.
Okay.
Whereas building up to the long-term support release, they strip out anything that's not quite working or things that were put in by as a test or experimentally and make sure everything is solid, working perfectly. Then they have a long-term support release, and then the next release after that, they start messing around again. So with the user interface that they have in place right now, which is called Unity, they have made it more like a tablet interface. It has big buttons on the left-hand side that you can click on for icons. They don't really have as much of a desktop metaphor for that we're all used to on Windows and Mac. And they're really changing the way you use Linux, really changing the whole user interface.
It sounds like they're trying to innovate.
They are definitely innovating.
Okay.
And
Is that a bad thing?
No, not at all. It's just that with the latest release, including Unity, Unity wasn't quite ready. And not that it had bugs, but there were features missing.
Okay.
There were things you couldn't do. And what the Unity interface looks like is a little more it's very similar to what they were using on their netbook editions, where the screen real estate was very limited.
Oh, okay.
So they have huge icons down the left-hand side in kind of a dock. You might think of it as a dock of applications. Mm-hmm. And so you click on the application, it runs, and much like on the Macintosh dock, you get an indicator on the dock that the application is running, and it will add icons if you start additional programs. And other than the ones that you have put on the dock as bookmarks or placeholders or launchers, it will remove those additional ones that you have launched if you have if you close the last instance of that particular application running. And they have removed the in Ubuntu, there's an upper menu bar
right.
that worked very similar to the Windows taskbar,
right.
Yeah, the task manager and the start button. And the menus for an application were on the window, much like they appear
like they
in
Windows.
Yeah, like they
right.
are in Windows. And on Unity, they had a universal menu bar, much like the Mac. So all the menus appear on the universal bar at the top. There are no menus in the windows themselves. You reach all the way up to the top of the screen for the menus.
Don't tell anybody, but I like the way Windows does that better.
Me too. But as we go forward, there may be more and more of the Linux distributions adopting this kind of user interface. But the reason I'm recommending Linux Mint is because, as I said, they're using the older user interface, and I'm going to wait until Ubuntu gets things settled before I start recommending Ubuntu again.
So in the show notes, you had actually tried to get me to start at the problem to be solved, so maybe we should back up and ask that question.
Well, let's do that.
I made you start in the middle.
That's okay. It was probably a question that got me started. And once you get me wound up,
you're the best guest. I can just ask a question. I'll go off and read a book. I'll come back. You'll be interesting while I'm gone.
If I ask you a question in the middle, though, you got to pay attention.
Oh, no. I am. I promise.
Okay. Well, here's the problem to be solved as I see it. So you love your Macintosh hardware, and you love the simplicity of the Mac OS X design, but you're a geek.
Yeah,
I think
baby.
You can relate to that. You also want more control. You want to be able to tweak your computers, your computer in ways that Apple's products just don't let you do. You appreciate Mr. Jobs' design philosophy that there should be just one way to do something. But you want more options. You want 8 ways to do things. You want a way that you can you want to be able to choose the method of working that works best for you instead of the other way around, the way that works best for Steve Jobs. And you do not want to be subject to the risk of viruses and malware that Windows would bring, so you don't want to use Windows to get your geek fix.
Right.
So that's the problem.
It's not that extreme of a problem.
I think it's a realistic problem, though.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Excuse me. So
we want to fool around, and we want to play with something different. We've got a Mac. We've got VMware or Parallels or something like that. We want to play around with a new OS. What can we do?
Well, you can install Linux Mint. And what that will do is it'll allow you to use your lovely Mac hardware and still be able to tweak to your heart's content. I think I mentioned on the last my last appearance on your show that I had spoken with Nightwise about installing Linux on a Mac. So we have all the instructions on how to do that, and the fact that when you do the installation, there may be some things that you have to tweak because it is different hardware than you might find on a PC. But the folks who make Ubuntu, and since Linux Mint is based on Ubuntu, the folks that make Linux Mint have taken the Mac hardware into consideration and given support for Mac hardware as well as PC hardware in their installation process.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So they're really taking this into account.
Yep,
it's made
exactly.
For us.
Yes, it is. So it's not like you're installing some alien operating system onto your pristine Mac hardware. Well, maybe Steve Jobs would would argue with that.
Right, right.
So you may be wondering, if I do start using Linux Mint, how much of a change am I going to see in the way things work? And is this going to be something that's going to take an awful lot of adjusting?
Right, right. Because I've dived in before, but I get scared after a while. It's hard.
Well, it's unfamiliar. It's right. Not really hard. Not these days, anyway. I don't know how long ago it was.
Probably the last time we talked.
Okay, well, and you just downloaded it. That was the easy part. So, if you are... And I'm here's somebody who's speaking from my perception of how the Mac works, and having looked at my daughter's MacBook Pro, which she's the first person in our family to own a Macintosh computer. So bear that
in
mind. Yeah, it is. Well, it's in her house.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's just going to visit yours?
Yeah, she brings it over to visit. But Linux is much more similar to the Mac than it is to Windows, quite frankly.
Huh.
And I think it's because of the common Unix origins of both.
Oh, right, right, right.
So you'll find
I do like that I can jump into Linux into the terminal when I have to. I find that kind of fun.
Exactly, and you can do things in the Mac that you can do on Unix computers and on Linux computers as well. So you would feel very at home for a number of different reasons. First of all, the structure of the hard drive is very similar to what's on the Mac. You have a home folder. You don't have the My Documents folder.
Okay.
And your hard drives are SDA and SDB, not C:/ and D:/.
Now, to be honest, I'm not used to calling my hard drives SDA and SDAB or SDB.
Right.
I sort of call them things like Fatso and Speedy or my two hard drives.
And you can name them in Linux as well.
Oh, okay.
But when you're at the command line, you do need to know that it's SDA or SDB. unless you have, as I do, just one hard drive, and then it's just the hard drive.
Okay.
So another thing that Mac OS X has gotten recently is something called Spaces, right?
Right. Well, it's had Spaces for quite some time, but now they've gotten rid of Spaces.
Okay, and they've gone to...
They call them, they're sort of like desktops.
Okay, and in Linux they're called desktops.
Oh, interesting. So maybe OS X went towards Linux in that.
Well, at least in the terminology, Linux has had virtual desktops for quite a while as well. And if I remember correctly, Linux may have had them before Mac. I believe that's the case.
I think that might be right.
Yeah, and so you can have up to, well, let me ask, do you know how many desktops you can have on a Mac? What's the maximum number?
All right, I'm up to 4. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
You'll be going for a while.
11. Okay. Oh, God, how do I get rid of all these? Oh, there you go.
Sorry about that.
So is there a limit?
There is a limit.
That was a rhetorical question. I thought you actually wanted to know. You're just messing with me, Larry.
No, I'm not messing with you. What I do know is that the limit on the Mac is much lower than it is on Linux. And I believe, I haven't checked to see if they've increased it, but I believe it's 256. What you would do with 256 desktops, I don't know. And how would you keep them all straight? I don't know.
Well, but, I got to 10. I'm using 2 right now, and I got real confused earlier today. So
yeah. Well, Linux is a geek's operating system.
And so it's sort of like bragging rights.
Yes, exactly.
And you're way more than lying. You only have like 120.
Yeah, yeah. Or whatever it is. I don't know what it is. But another thing that you may be familiar with on the Mac is something called Exposé.
Yeah, which I don't know if they have anymore.
They've been taking a lot of this stuff out in Lion, from what I understand. I've heard this is the second time I've heard it. But there are a number of desktop effects in Linux that allow you to do things like have your windows wobble as you move them around the screen and various other things. And
I love stuff like that. I mean, you know, they only did it because they can. There's no other reason than
that's
what he's talking about. Is it basically looks like it turned into rubber jello or something as you're moving the windows around.
Right, and the faster you drag it with your mouse, the more it wiggles. So you're absolutely right. There's no purpose to it other than to be able to say, wow.
Well, I remember when, I think pretty early on, one of the desktops or one of the distros in Linux actually allowed you to, when you change spaces or you change users, it flipped as a cube, and that was all really cool, that kind of thing.
And
By the way, they replaced it with Mission Control is what it's called, which is sort of like Exposé, only not quite.
Okay, so they changed the name and made it do a
different
things. Okay, right. Well, you can set up the same sort of desktop effects as Exposé on Linux as well. And it's the same program that actually does the spinning cube and the flipping and wobbly windows that allows you to do that kind of setup. So if you like fancy desktop effects, like when you minimize a window, it kind of magic lamps down to your taskbar, all that sort of thing. It is Linux is the operating system for you. Another similar sort of thing that might help you in your transition is to think of the Mac App Store as a place where you go to get your applications.
Right.
And in Linux Mint, they have the software manager where you can go to get your software applications.
Okay, so this is right where I always get stuck, because being a geek, just having an operating system that runs and functions perfectly, that's not what we're intending to do. We need to be able to add more applications. So as soon as I get to that point, somebody's going to tell me about all these scary things I have to go do, and then I run away screaming and I go back to my Mac.
Well, yeah, the software manager is much more like the Mac App Store, but where everything is free. So you can find things very easily in the software manager. And I think we had this discussion last time, which is instead of going to the command line and typing in all the cryptic commands to install stuff, or going to the Synaptic Package Manager that has all kinds of knobs and bells and buttons and fields and search terms.
Everybody told me that was going to be easy, and that wasn't easy either.
Yeah, the software manager is easy. You click on it, you open it, you search for the application you want, either by its name if you know it, or by its function if you don't.
Oh, okay, so you could put in Twitter, and it would find Twitter clients?
Yeah, and you could find, if you want a word processor, you can type in word processor.
Okay, but what happens next? Do I have to do something scary when I find what I want?
You have to
double click.
You can click on the button that says install.
Ooh, I might be able to do that, Larry.
Yeah, okay, good.
Might be in my skill set.
All right. And then the next thing, as a true geek, you can't do without the terminal. And in Linux, you have the terminal just as you do on the Mac, and you can use SSH. I heard you talking about SSH.
Oh, I'm all over SSH.
Episode. Okay. You can use sudo.
Okay.
You can do scripting, and you can use regular expressions exactly as you do on the Mac.
Okay. So, but I don't have to, right?
No, absolutely not. If you just want to stay in the little box that is the graphical user interface, you can do that. But if you're a geek, you're going to want to use the terminal. And yes, it's there for you in Linux.
You know, and I will.
Of course. And you have all of the same commands that you have on the Mac in the Linux terminal, because it's got the same Unix base. So there may be some Mac-specific commands, and there may be some Linux-specific commands that are different between those two operating systems. But at its root, the no pun intended, at its root, they are the same. So in at the terminal, instead of typing dir for a listing of the files in that directory as you do in Windows, both on Linux and the Mac, you type ls.
Yeah, right.
And so it's all Linux commands or Unix commands that you're using. So, Allison, let's get you started installing.
Let's do it.
Okay, and I don't know whether you're going to try to do this as we're
probably
we're
not going. While we go.
Yeah, that's something that my co-host Tom likes to do as we're recording the podcast. If I mention something new, and I have tended now not to mention huge packages that will actually...
Because he'll start downloading them?
He will not only download, he'll install them as we're recording.
Okay. So I've been having trouble with Lion, where mm-hmm. I can't drag and drop files. I don't know what's going on, but a lot of people are saying I'm crazy and that it's not happening to them. But I did download Linux Mint before we got started, and it's in my downloads folder, but I want to move it over to my external hard drive where I actually keep my VM so I can run it from there. And okay. I tried dragging and dropping it before we left, and we started, and it didn't work. So I just did a search, and I was looking at ways to fix it, and I was 5 seconds from relaunching the Finder while I was talking to you.
Resist the temptation.
Yeah, and I thought, wait, that would be dumb. That could cause a problem, maybe. It probably would have been fine, actually.
Yeah.
But still, probably not worth the risk.
Why risk it? Yes.
But, I mean, I had copied the command and was about to hit paste. I went, shouldn't do that.
Maybe not. Okay.
I did download it before we got started, though, so
okay,
I'm partway
there. You got step one. All right. So in that step one, though, I've provided a link to a screencast that I had done on how to download and create a bootable CD. And, of course, you can also boot from a thumb drive if you'd rather use USB.
Okay.
And so either way is fine. And, of course, if you're doing this in a virtual machine, you can treat that ISO image as though it were a virtual disk, a virtual CD, rather than have to actually burn it. But I've got a tutorial and in that screencast. It's a little old, so we're downloading an older version of Linux.
But the concepts are still the same.
The concepts are still the same. And I have instructions on how to do it from a Linux machine if you're already on Linux, and also I've done it from a Windows machine if you're on Windows. Now, as I mentioned to you before we started, I don't have a Mac computer at home here where I can actually record a screencast. So I've also got a link that I've put in our notes here on how to burn the ISO on a Mac. And that's a couple of years old, but it should still apply, I think.
It's real easy to burn ISOs on the Mac. In fact,
You've been using a Mac for a while, I'm sure you already know, right?
Yeah, that was what probably one of the biggest shocks to me when I went to Windows. One of the early things I had to do, I have to use Windows at work, and I had been on a Mac until probably only 3, maybe 4 years ago. So I went straight to Vista, which was a real fun time. Mm-hmm. But I went in there and I needed to burn an ISO. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'll just download the ISO. So, okay, I'm going to right click and say burn. And there wasn't anything there.
There's nothing there. Yeah.
Yeah. And I start asking people and they're like, oh, no, you have to buy software to do that. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. You have to pay for software to burn a disk? That can't be right. And I searched for probably more than a week, and finally one guy I knew. And by the way, all my friends are sysadmins. Mm-hmm. And one guy knew of an ISO burning application for Windows at the time. This is several years ago, and that was that you didn't have to pay for. And I was just I thought, okay, so Macs cost a lot more than Windows boxes, but apparently they charge you, you know, $5 at a time to get you back up to the same price. It's like, how often am I going to run into this? It didn't happen that often, but my first thing I found was that. So yeah, I took it for granted. Right, you right click on it and you go like burn it to a CD. Now, I don't have an optical drive anymore. A lot of people go on MacBook Air, so it's good to know you can do it to a thumb drive. That's good advice. By the way, to people listening, there is a trick to making bootable thumb drives, and I didn't figure it out until I watched Don McAllister's screencast online where he explains how to install Lion on a thumb drive, that you actually have to look at not just how it's formatted, making sure that it's the right format, like you don't want it FAT32, which is the Windows OS, but there's a more basic layer under that. You don't want it to be master boot record. You need it to be GUID partition table. I have no idea what that means, but I like to hear John F. Braun say it. It's sexy when he does it. But anyway, you do need to have GUID. So if you get stuck, like you think you made a bootable one and it won't boot off of it, that's why. So make sure you do that. It's under an advanced tab in there somewhere.
Okay.
So
that was all great to me, Allison. So
sorry, just trying to help everybody keep up here.
I understood USB. Okay, moving right along. So I know you're probably going to want to try this out in a virtual machine, right?
Right.
So what are you using as your virtual machine?
Nowadays, I'm favoring VMware, but they're both pretty good. VMware, Fusion, and Parallels just sort of bounce back and forth is the best, so either one.
All right. VMware is available for Linux, Windows, and Mac, so that's one that a lot of folks will try out. There is a free
From Sun, right?
Yeah, VirtualBox, which is now from Oracle.
And so Oracle's keeping that up then? They haven't wrecked it?
They haven't wrecked it yet.
Okay.
So I'm using that one, and it's a very similar process in either case, and we'll probably not get into all the intricacies of virtual machines.
Yeah, I've done that before. I've walked them through how to do it. So it's so much easier than it was years ago, and even with the open source VirtualBox, it's a piece of cake.
Yeah, it's really, really easy these days. What I did find out, though, through personal experience in installing Linux Mint 11 in VirtualBox, there is, and I'm not sure whether this is a bug or an incompatibility or whatever, but it's something that's mentioned in the Linux Mint release notes for Linux Mint 11, that there's a slight modification that you have to make to a file after you get it installed in a virtual machine. And it doesn't appear to happen on every virtual machine, but it is something that I had to do in VirtualBox. So I've included a note right at the bottom of all of our notes here that gives a link to the release notes where it talks about how to do that.
So why do you have to do that? It's scary. It's got Linux commands in it.
Yeah.
You promised.
Yeah. Well, you didn't say you were going to install in a virtual machine.
Oh, no.
But, okay, so really all it is open a file in a text editor and replace some text with some other text. Although it looks, looking at what it says to do, it says modify /etc/xdg/. I can see where it seems very, very geeky. And hey, we're geeks, right?
Right. I am quite comfortable, though, simply copying, pasting commands in blindly, not knowing what they mean.
Okay, good, good. Then this is for you.
It's possible that's going to hurt me someday.
Yeah, someday it might, yes.
I only do it from trusted sources, though.
Okay, well, am I a trusted source?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you hesitated.
Well, the problem is that the person vouching for you is Nightwise, and he's always been a little suspicious and dodgy.
Okay. So. All right, I'll give you that. Okay, so moving right along, once you have either the CD in your CD drive, you have the thumb drive in the USB port, or you have the virtual machine ready to launch as though it were booting from a CD, you would boot from whatever the device is. So boot up the computer or the virtual machine from the CD or the USB drive, and then once it is booted, and the first time you're booting from one of these live environments, a live CD or a live USB, it may take a little longer than normal because it's trying to load a lot of stuff into RAM that's compressed on the device, if it's a USB flash drive, or on the CD. And so it does take a little longer than you would expect. But be patient. It will eventually boot to a Linux Mint desktop.
Oh, okay. Right off the CD or the DVD or the thumb drive.
Yep. And the purpose of that is so that you can try it out, check it out with your hardware, make sure everything works before you commit it, for installation. So if you find out that, your camera doesn't work, and you rely on your camera for a lot of stuff, maybe you want to try a different distribution, or maybe you want to look around and see if there is a driver for that camera that you can install after the fact. But generally speaking, with PC hardware, and from what I understand from Nightwise, with the Mac hardware, it should just work. So, but the reason you have the live CD is to test it out, check it out, make sure that there's no problem.
Well, another use I've heard of using the live CDs is, let's say you're having a hardware problem in your native OS. You can pop in the live CD, and let's say it is that camera, but then you go into Linux and the camera works just fine. Then you know it's a software problem.
Exactly right. And there are also other tools that you can use in Linux for repairing your PC, your Windows installation, the master boot record in Windows. Mm-hmm. There are even live CDs of nothing but tools for repairing computers and operating systems and file systems that have Linux as the base operating system that they run on, but they are tools for repairing Windows or repairing Linux. Because I don't have a Mac, I don't know whether they're tools for repairing Mac or not, but probably some of those tools will work on a Mac as well.
Right. By the way, you did just say master boot record, so you did know what I was talking about when I said master boot record versus GUID partition.
Yes. Yes, I did. You got me. Yes. Well, I try not to play too much of a geek on
it's not working.
Yeah, okay. All right, you got me. So after you've booted, the next thing you'll find is you're in this desktop, and there will be three icons on the desktop. There will be computer, there will be Mint's home, Mint as in Linux Mint, and if this were installed on your computer, it would say Allison's home or whatever your username is. And then there is an icon on the desktop that says install Linux Mint. That's it. Now, there's a menu in the bottom left, and you can click on that, and you can explore around. You can browse the web if your network is working. And if it's not, just find the wireless icon in the lower right and click on it, and you can put in your WPA passcode or whatever you want to get on the wireless network. Or if you're wired, it should work.
When I did Ubuntu 9.10, it actually pulled my credentials from the Apple keychain and already knew how to get on my network.
Yes, it will do that.
That's when I just went, okay, Mama, we're not in Kansas anymore. You know, what is going on here?
Yeah, if you are booting from the live CD onto your computer or a live USB, it will do that, whether it's Mac or Windows. It will try to find the settings for you. And
that's crazy.
Of course, in the virtual machine, it won't do that, of course. But if you're trying it on your live hardware, your real hardware, it will do that. Pretty cool, huh?
Wow. Yeah, it's just come so far.
It really has.
It's just astonishing what it's done, really.
So I've got some screenshots of the installation process just to make you feel more comfortable. And after you double-click the Install Linux Mint icon on the desktop, the first little window that pops up is called Install, and it says Preparing to Install Linux Mint. And it asks you a couple of questions. Actually, it gives you some advice. It says make sure you have at least 4.7 gigabytes available on the drive. Why 4.7? I don't know. They could have rounded it off to 5, but it's 4.7. Can you tell this is an operating system for geeks? Make sure your computer is plugged into a power source.
Ah, okay.
That's just in case you're running off the battery and the battery dies in the middle of the installation. You don't want that to happen. But if you have a fully charged battery and you know it will last longer than 20 minutes, you're good. And make sure your computer is connected to the internet.
Why is that important?
That is so that it can get the updates as you're doing the installation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So if you don't have a connection to the internet, you can still do the installation. So if your network is down or you're in a place where you don't have internet, no problem. You can still do the installation. But just be prepared, like when you install Windows, to get a bazillion updates, especially if it's a release of Linux Mint that has been out for a little while. There will be some updates. So, once you've read through those three little things, there are three buttons. You can quit. That's the chicken's way out. There is back, which, when you're on the first screen, probably doesn't take you any more back any further. And then forward. So you would click forward.
Okay.
All right. And the next thing it's going to present to you is in another little window, it will now say allocate drive space, which is nothing more than let's make room on my hard drive. And you've got two options. Your option is to erase the disk and install Linux Mint. Probably not something you want to do if you're intending to dual boot. It is something that you can do on your virtual machine, though, since there's nothing already on that virtual hard drive.
So you would pick that instead of – it's not going to erase my hard drive if I'm installing it in a VM?
Yeah. If you're in a VM, no. The only hard drive it sees is the one that you've created for the VM. So that's safe in your VM. The other one is labeled something else. That's the label, something else. And what that allows you to do is to actually create a partition for Linux Mint on your hard drive. And if you don't know what that is, here's your chance to back out.
That's what the back button's for.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or the quit, right? So there are plenty of tutorials on how to partition your hard drive if you don't know how to do that. And there are videos on YouTube and so on. So let's just bypass that. Let's assume you're going to install it in a virtual machine because you want to try it out. So you click forward, and the next thing that comes up is, since we chose to erase the entire hard drive, it shows me erase disk and install Linux Mint. And it shows me a selector that allows me to choose the hard drive that I want to install it on. And since my virtual machine had only one hard drive, there was only one selection there. It had selected it for me. But if you had more than one hard drive, you could choose to install it on an external drive if you wish. And you could install it beside your existing installation if you wanted to, beside your existing operating system, if you're Windows or Mac or whatever.
Okay.
So there you go. So as you can see on the screenshot, I had an 8 gigabyte hard drive that I set aside. 8 gigabytes seems a little small, but that's all it really needs to run Linux Mint and still have some room for data.
So I have a confession to make, Larry.
Uh-huh.
I'm, of course, installing it while we're talking. And it said it needed 23 gigabytes.
Okay. Oh,
well, you know, I might be. No, that is what I thought it said.
It may have said that it is going to create 23.
Maybe.
Partition of that size.
Maybe.
And maybe that's, generally speaking, if
well,
you're
I took the 64-bit version. Does that matter?
No, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It might take a little bit more space, but probably not. But you can install Linux Mint in 8 gigabytes without any trouble at all. Then once you select the hard drive, you click Install Now. And it begins to copy files onto that hard drive partition. And while it's doing that, it's asking you some more questions. So it says, where are you? It's not looking for anything more than a time zone. Mm-hmm. But you can click on the little graphical map and choose your time zone that way. Or you can type into the little field that's in the bottom, the city that you're in, and it will try to figure out where you are. And usually some combination of both of those will get you where you want to be. And if you're installing this on a computer that already has an operating system on it, it will pick up the time zone from your current installation. And all you really have to do is click forward. Click the button. And now you're at the second last dialog box before you just sit back and wait for it to install. And this one is asking you for your keyboard layout. So if you're using a standard keyboard layout, and it will try to figure out what your keyboard layout is from its hardware detection, and it automatically found mine as a US keyboard.
I'm going to pick Belgian just to confuse myself.
Okay. Well, you could get some help from Nightwise if you really get into trouble there.
We actually took a lot of pictures of Belgian keyboards or the different keyboard layouts and found that fascinating when we were in Europe with them. That was interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And I heard you in a recent episode speaking with a guest from Canada.
Right.
Who was talking about the French keyboard layout that he uses in
That's
French.
That's right. That was Pierre.
Yeah.
So another thing it does do, since I am installing it while recording a podcast, is it actually is giving me a slideshow to show me what's new in Linux or in Linux Mint. So it's showing me, like, here's where your music goes, and you use Banshee to play it, and here's where you watch videos with VLC, and it's really cool. It looks beautiful.
It is. Yeah, you get an education while you're doing the installation. Look at that. So for those of you who are following along but not quite at the level that Allison is, you are still at the keyboard layout. You select your keyboard, click forward. It will ask you for your username, the name you want to give your computer, and your login credentials, so which are your username and password. And once you've done that, it will begin to show you the slideshow that Allison's looking at and begin the installation. So let me know when it's finished and we'll pause.
Well, I don't think it's going to get done before we're done. It's got 6.5 minutes to go. We have been going on for quite some time.
Yeah.
But this is really fun. This looks really easy and fun, and I just love messing around like this.
Oh, it
is. Especially putting something on my computer, you know, right before I'm going to record a live show. You know, I like to.
Or while you're recording a live show.
Right, while I'm recording a live show. Come on, what fun would that be?
Yeah, exactly. So once you've got it installed, it will ask you, do you want to reboot or do you want to continue trying out Linux Mint? So you could still browse around in the live environment if you wish, or if you want to reboot, remember to take the CD out, or it'll reboot to the CD, right? If when you reboot, you see the Install Linux Mint icon on your desktop, it's booted back to the CD. when you reboot, you will be asked for your username and password, unless you chose the option to log in automatically, which is not very secure. But it is possible. Then you'll be using Linux Mint, and you can check it out, play around with the applications, go to the Software Center, install new stuff, and enjoy your newfound geekiness on your Mac hardware.
All right, Larry, this time, I promise, I'm actually doing it. Actually, since I'm doing it while we're talking, I can prove that I'm doing it.
Yeah, there's no backing out now.
Right. So I promise by the next time we talk, I will try to have more advanced questions, and I'll just be all over this Linux thing. You know, I'll be hanging with the geeks.
Okay, sounds good. And in the meantime, if you have questions, holler at me. I'll help you out.
Yeah, why don't you tell people where they can find you and about the different things you do on the web?
Sure. Well, the website is goinglinux.com, and that's where you'll find articles and show notes and screencasts and all kinds of things to help you out. It's really a full-featured resource for people trying out Linux. There are also subscription links on there to the podcast. And so whatever your podcast listening preferences are, whether you're on iTunes, and there's no iTunes, by the way, for Linux. You want to talk to Steve about that? We need iTunes for Linux.
I think a lot of people would say, please don't put iTunes on Linux.
Please don't. Yes. If it's anything like what they did in Windows, I'm happy not to use it. Thank you.
Right.
So whether you're using Banshee or Rhythmbox or GPotter or Miro or any of those things on Linux or Windows or Mac, feel free to listen there and subscribe to the Going Linux podcast there. We're on Twitter, Going Linux. We're on Identica, Going Linux. We're even on Google Plus.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
But you're on as Larry Bushy there, right?
Well, yeah.
And on Twitter, you're Going Linux.
Yep.
So the best way to ask you questions and engage with you, would that be Twitter, or where would you suggest people go, or do you give out your email address?
Well, I give out my email address, and it's goinglinux@gmail.com.
Great.
Yeah, and that's really the best place to get a hold of me, because I'm not, contrary to popular belief, I'm not sitting on Twitter or Identica or Google Plus all day long. I have a full-time job, and some of those things are blocked.
Oh, yeah. That's too bad.
Gotta love that.
All right, Larry. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. I always have a lot of fun talking to you, and I like it because you stretch me. You make me go a little bit further each time, and if we just sit back and know what we know, then what's the fun of that?
Right. Well, next time we'll stretch a little more.
All right, Larry. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Well, as you heard during the interview, I actually did install Linux Mint into a virtual machine using VMware's Fusion while we were doing the interview. Probably a dangerous thing to do, but I did it anyway. I've been playing with it all week, and it's very cool. Now, I mentioned that I always get stuck in installing software in Linux, and I've had to enlist Kyle McGuire's help on a lot of occasions because I usually get stuck. By the way, he's at KyleMag on Twitter. And he would take me into the command line where he'd tell me what to type, and he would always help me perfectly well. And while that was fun and geeky, I could rarely reproduce what he was teaching me the next time I got stuck. Using Linux Mint has been a dream in comparison. Now, I should say that I skipped a version of Ubuntu, so maybe the middle version of Ubuntu in between those two would have been just as easy, because he's telling me in the chat room that some of the things I'm going to talk about are in Ubuntu. But I got to tell you, using Linux Mint has been a dream. For example, I installed Pidgin with a couple of clicks using the Software Center. Pidgin is an open source app that lets you connect into various chat services like AIM, GTalk, and even Facebook. I live on Atom on the Mac that gives you all those services, so it was fun to be able to immediately get online with all those services in Linux. I simply opened that software center, and I went into internet or something like that, and I picked it out, found it, double-click, I was installed. Now, one dodgy part I did have, though, was when I had to install the VMware tools into Linux Mint. Let me back up a little bit. Whenever you build a virtual machine using any virtual machine tool with any operating system, you have to install these tools. It's really easy to install the OS, but the tools are a little bit tricky. If you don't install them, things won't work exactly right. Maybe you'll have trouble printing or sharing folders between your host and a guest OS will be janky, or your optical drive won't be visible, those kinds of problems, physical interface kind of stuff. Well, I tried to install the tools on my own, but all it would do was mount a virtual optical disk on my Mint desktop. I tried opening that, and it mounted another thing that appeared to be sort of a compressed tar file. All right, so I opened that, and I saw an installer inside, so I double-clicked it, but nothing happened. I started penning this really long, whiny email to Larry to tell him that Linux was crap, but as I wrote the email, I had another idea. My problem was that I was thinking like a Mac. See, on the Mac, if you double-click an archived or compressed disk, it uncompresses. But then I remembered that on Windows, double-clicking an archive file does not archive it. You have to specifically ask it to uncompress, and only then are you truly touching what's inside. I thought maybe Linux was doing it the Windows way, which, by the way, I consider a complete tease, but, you know, letting me see inside but not touch it. So sure enough, I right-clicked on it in Linux Mint, and there was the option to unarchive it. And then I had the real VMware tools right there to double-click and install. I decided to keep my whiny email going to Larry, but include my discovery so he'd know I'd had success. He, of course, loved it because halfway through he thought he'd be spending the next week teaching me Unix commands that I'd forget anyway, but then he was rewarded by learning of my success using the GUI instead, so no work at all for him. I gotta tell you, I'm really impressed by Linux Mint, and I plan to play with it a lot more. Thanks for pushing me again, Larry. Well, that's going to wind it up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. We've got Screen Steps and Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing them to me at allison@podfeet.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And don't forget to send in audio recordings to katiefloyd@macpowerusers.com for next week's show. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, I highly recommend it. Head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. All the instructions are there. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.